Chapter 20. Now the final copper light of afternoon fades. Now the street beyond the low maples and the low signboard is prepared and empty, framed by the study window like a stage. He can remember how when he was young, after he first came to Jefferson from the seminary, how that fading copper light would seem almost audible, like a dying yellow fall of trumpets dying into an interval of silence and waiting, out of which they would presently come. Already, even before the falling horns had ceased, it would seem to him that he could hear the beginning thunder, not yet louder than a whisper, a rumor in the air. But he'd never told anyone that, not even her. Not even her in the days when they were still the night's lovers, and shame and division hadn't come, and she knew, and had not forgot with division and regret and then despair, why he would sit here at this window and wait for nightfall, for the instant of night. Not even to her. To woman. The woman. Woman. Not the seminary, as he'd once believed. The passive and anonymous whom God had created to be not alone the recipient and receptacle of the seed of his body, but of his spirit, too. Which is truth, or as near truth, as he dare approach. He was an only child. When he was born, his father was 50 years old, and his mother had been an invalid for almost 20 years. He grew up to believe that this was the result of the food which she had had to subsist on during the last year of the Civil War. Perhaps this was the reason. His father had owned no slaves, though he was the son of a man who did own slaves at the time. He could have owned them, but though born and bred and dwelling in an age and land where to own slaves was less expensive than to not own them, he would neither eat food grown and cooked by, nor sleep in a bed prepared by, a Negro slave. Hence, during the war, and while he was absent from home, his wife had no garden save what she could make herself, or with the infrequent aid of neighbors. And this aid the husband wouldn't allow her to accept for the reason that it couldn't be repaid in kind. "God will provide," he said. Provide what? Dandelions and ditch weeds. Then he will give us the bowels to digest them. He was a minister. For a year he'd been leaving home early each Sunday morning before his father, this was before the son's marriage, who, though a member in good standing of the Episcopal Church, hadn't entered any church since the son could remember, discovered where he went. He found that the son, then just turned 21, was riding 16 miles each Sunday to preach in a small Presbyterian chapel back in the hills. The father laughed. The son listened to the laughter as he would if it had been shouts or curses, with a cold and respectful detachment, saying nothing. The next Sunday he went back to his congregation. When the war began, the son wasn't among the first to go. Neither was he among the last. And he stayed with the troops for 4 years, though he fired no musket and wore instead of uniform the somber frock coat which he'd purchased to be married in and which he'd used to preach in. When he returned home in 65, he still wore it, though he never put it on again after that day when the wagon stopped at the front steps and 2 men lifted him down and carried him into the house and laid him on the bed. His wife removed the coat and put it away in a trunk in the attic. It stayed there for 25 years, until one day his son opened the trunk and took it out and spread out the careful folds in which it had been arranged by hands that were now dead. He remembers it now, sitting in the dark window in the quiet study, waiting for twilight to cease, for night and the galloping hooves. The copper light is completely gone now. The world hangs in a green suspension, in color and texture, like light through colored glass. Soon it will be time to begin to say, soon now, now soon. I was 8 then, he thinks. It was raining. It seems to him that he can still smell the rain, the moist grieving of the October earth, and the musty yawn as the lid of the trunk went back. Then the garment, the neat folds. He didn't know what it was, because at first he was almost overpowered by the evocation of his dead mother's hands which lingered among the folds. Then it opened, tumbling slowly. To him, the child, it seemed unbelievably huge, as though made for a giant, as though merely from having been worn by one of them, the cloth itself had assumed the properties of those phantoms who loomed heroic and tremendous against a background of thunder and smoke and torn flags which now filled his waking and sleeping life. The garment was almost unrecognizable with patches. Patches of leather, man-sewn and crude. Patches of Confederate gray, weathered leaf-brown now. And one that stopped his very heart. It was blue. Dark blue. The blue of the United States. Looking at this patch, at the mute and anonymous cloth, the boy, the child born into the autumn of his mother's and father's lives, whose organs already required the unflagging care of a Swiss watch, would experience a kind of hushed and triumphant terror, which left him a little sick. That evening, at supper, he'd be unable to eat. Looking up, the father, now a man nearing 60, would find the child staring at him with terror and awe, and with something else. Then the man would say, "What have you been into now?" And the child couldn't answer, couldn't speak, staring at his father with on his child's face an expression as of the pit itself. That night, in bed, he wouldn't be able to sleep. He would lie rigid, not even trembling, in his dark bed, while the man who was his father and his only remaining relative, and between whom and himself there was so much of distance in time that not even the decades of years could measure, that there was not even any physical resemblance, slept walls and floors away. And the next day the child would suffer one of his intestinal fits. But he wouldn't tell what it was, not even to the Negro woman who ran the household, and who was his mother, too, and nurse. Gradually his strength would return, and then one day he would steal again to the attic and open the trunk and take out the coat and touch the blue patch with that horrified triumph and sick joy, and wonder if his father had killed the man from whose blue coat the patch came. Wondering with still more horror yet at the depth and strength of his desire and dread to know. Yet on the very next day, when he knew that his father had gone to call upon one of his country patients and wouldn't possibly return before dark, he would go to the kitchen and say to the Negro woman, "Tell again about Grandpa. How many Yankees did he kill?" And when he listened now, it was without terror. It wasn't even triumph. It was pride. This grandfather was the single thorn in his son's side. The son would no more have said that than he would have thought it, any more than it would ever have occurred to either of them to wish mutually that he'd been given a different son or a different father. Their relations were peaceable enough, being on the son's part a cold, humorless, automatically respectful reserve, and on the father's a bluff, direct, coarsely vivid humor, which lacked less of purport than wit. They lived amicably enough in the two-story house in town, though for some time now the son had refused, quiet and firm, to eat any food prepared by the slave woman who had raised him from babyhood. He cooked his own food in the kitchen, to the negress's outraged indignation, and put it on the table himself, and ate it face to face with his father, who saluted him punctiliously and unfailingly with a glass of bourbon whiskey. This, too, the son didn't touch, and had never tasted. On the son's wedding day, the father surrendered the house. He was waiting on the porch with the key to the house in his hand when the bride and groom arrived. He wore his hat and cloak. About him was piled his personal luggage, and behind him stood the two slaves which he owned, the Negro woman who cooked, and his boy, a man older than himself and who didn't have one remaining hair, who was the cook's husband. He wasn't a planter. He was a lawyer, who had learned law somewhat as his son was to learn medicine, by main strength and the devil's grace and luck, as he put it. He had already bought for himself a small house 2 miles in the country, and his surrey and his matched team stood before the porch waiting, while he too stood, his hat tilted back and his legs apart, a hale, bluff, red-nosed man with the mustache of a brigand chief, while the son and the daughter-in-law, whom he'd never seen before, came up the path from the gate. When he stooped and saluted her, she smelled whiskey and cigars. "I reckon you'll do," he said. His eyes were bluff and bold, but kind. "All the sanctimonious cuss wants, anyway, is somebody that can sing alto out of a Presbyterian hymn book, where even the good Lord himself couldn't squeeze in any music." He drove away in the tasseled surrey, with his personal belongings about him, his clothes, his demijohn, his slaves. The slave cook didn't even remain to prepare the first meal. She wasn't offered, and so not refused. The father never entered the house again alive. He would have been welcome. He and the son both knew this without it ever being said. And the wife, she was one of many children of a genteel couple who had never got ahead, and who seemed to find in the church some substitute for that which lacked upon the dinner table, liked him, admired him in a hushed, alarmed, secret way, his swagger, his bluff, and simple adherence to a simple code. They would hear of his doings, though, of how in the next summer after he removed to the country he invaded a protracted alfresco church revival being held in a nearby grove and turned it into a week of amateur horse racing, while to a dwindling congregation gaunt, fanatic-faced country preachers thundered anathema from the rustic pulpit at his oblivious and unregenerate head. His reason for not visiting his son and his daughter-in-law was apparently frank. "You'd find me dull, and I'd find you dull, and who knows? The cuss might corrupt me. Might corrupt me in my old age into heaven." But that wasn't the reason. The son knew that it wasn't. Who would have been the first to fight the aspersion, were it to come from another, that there was delicacy of behavior and thought in the old man? The son was an abolitionist. Almost before the sentiment had become a word to percolate down from the north. Though when he learned that the Republicans did have a name for it, he completely changed the name of his conviction, without abating his principles or behavior one jot. Even then, not yet 30, he was a man of Spartan sobriety beyond his years, as the offspring of a not overly particular servant of chance, and the bottle often is. Perhaps that accounted for the fact that he had no child until after the war, from which he returned a changed man, deodorized, as his dead father would have put it, of sanctity somewhat. Although during those 4 years he had never fired a gun, his service wasn't alone that of praying and preaching to troops on Sunday mornings. When he returned home with his wound and recovered and established himself as a doctor, he was only practicing the surgery and the pharmacy which he'd practiced and learned on the bodies of friend and foe alike while helping the doctors at the front. This, probably of all the son's doings, the father would have enjoyed the most, that the son had taught himself a profession on the invader and devastator of his country. But Sanctity is not the word for him, the son's son in turn thinks, sitting at the dark window while outside the world hangs in that green suspension beyond the faded trumpets. Grandfather himself would have been the first to confront any man that employed that term. It was some throwback to the austere and not dim times not so long past, when a man in that country had little of himself to waste and little time to do it in, and had to guard and protect that little not only from nature, but from man too, by means of a sheer fortitude that didn't offer, in his lifetime anyway, physical ease for reward. That was where his disapproval of slavery lay, and of his lusty and sacrilegious father. The very fact that he could and did see no paradox in the fact that he took an active part in a partisan war, and on the very side whose principles opposed his own, was proof enough that he was two separate and complete people, one of whom dwelled by serene rules in a world where reality didn't exist. But the other part of him, which lived in the actual world, did as well as any and better than most. He lived by his principles in peace, and when war came he carried them into war and lived by them there, when there was preaching on peaceful Sundays and quiet groves to be done, he had done it, without any particular equipment for it other than his will and his convictions and what he could pick up as he went along. When there was the saving of wounded men under fire and the curing of them without proper tools, he did that too, again without other equipment save his strength and courage and what he could pick up as he went along. And when the war was lost, and the other men returned home with their eyes stubbornly reverted toward what they refused to believe was dead, he looked forward, and made what he could of defeat by making practical use of that which he had learned in it. He turned doctor. One of his first patients was his wife. Possibly he kept her alive. At least he enabled her to produce life, though he was 50 and she past 40 when the son was born. The son grew to manhood among phantoms, and side by side with a ghost. The phantoms were his father, his mother, and an old Negro woman. The father, who had been a minister without a church and a soldier without an enemy, and who in defeat had combined the two and become a doctor, a surgeon, it was as though the very cold and uncompromising conviction which propped him upright, as it were, between Puritan and Cavalier, had become not defeated and not discouraged, but wiser. As though it had seen in the smoke of cannon, as in a vision, that the laying on of hands meant literally that. As if he came suddenly to believe that Christ had meant that him whose spirit alone required healing was not worth the having, the saving. That was one phantom. The second was the mother, whom he remembers first and last as a thin face and tremendous eyes and a spread of dark hair on a pillow, with blue, still, almost skeleton hands. If on the day of her death he had been told that he'd ever seen her otherwise than in bed, he wouldn't have believed it. Later he remembered differently. He did remember her moving about the house, attending to household affairs. But at 8 and 9 and 10 he thought of her as without legs, feet, as being only that thin face and the two eyes which seemed daily to grow bigger and bigger, as though about to embrace all seeing, all life, with one last terrible glare of frustration and suffering and foreknowledge. And that when that finally happened he would hear it. It would be a sound like a cry. Already, before she died, he could feel them through all walls. They were the house. He dwelled within them, within their dark and all-embracing and patient aftermath of physical betrayal. He and she both lived in them like two small, weak beasts in a den, a cavern into which now and then the father entered, that man who was a stranger to them both, a foreigner, almost a threat. So quickly does the body's well-being alter and change the spirit. He was more than a stranger. He was an enemy. He smelled differently from them. He spoke with a different voice, almost in different words, as though he dwelled by ordinary among different surroundings and in a different world. Crouching beside the bed, the child could feel the man fill the room with rude health and unconscious contempt. He, too, as helpless and frustrated as they. The third phantom was the Negro woman, the slave, who'd ridden away in the surrey that morning when the son and his bride came home. She rode away a slave. She returned in 66, still a slave, on foot now, a huge woman with a face both irascible and calm, the mask of a black tragedy between scenes. After her master's death, and until she was convinced at last that she would never more see either him or her husband, the boy who had followed the master to the war, and who also didn't return, she refused to leave the house in the country to which her master had moved, and of which he had left her in charge when he rode away. After the father's death, the son went out to close the house and remove his father's private possessions, and he offered to make provision for her. She refused. She also refused to leave. She made her own small kitchen garden, and she lived there, alone, waiting for her husband to return, the rumor of whose death she refused to believe. It was just rumor, vague. How, following his master's death in Van Dorn's cavalry raid to destroy Grant's stores in Jefferson, the Negro had been inconsolable. One night he disappeared from the bivouac. Presently there began to come back tales of a crazy Negro who had been halted by Confederate pickets close to the enemy's front, who told the same garbled story about a missing master who was being held for ransom by the Yankees. They couldn't make him even entertain for a moment the idea that the master might be dead. "No, sir," he would say, "not Mars Gill, not him. They wouldn't dare to kill a Hightower. They wouldn't dare. They got him hid somewhere, trying to sweat out in him while me and him hid Mrs. Coffee Pot and the gold waiter. That's all they wants." Each time he would escape. Then one day word came back from the federal lines of a Negro who had attacked a Yankee officer with a shovel, forcing the officer to shoot him to protect his own life. The woman wouldn't believe this for a long time. "Not that he ain't fool enough to have done it," she said. "He just ain't got enough sense to know a Yankee to hit at with a shovel if he was to see him." She said that for over a year. Then one day she appeared at the son's home. The house which she'd quitted 10 years ago and hadn't entered since, carrying her possessions in a handkerchief. She walked into the house and said, "Here I is. You got enough wood in the box to cook supper with?" "You're free now," the son told her. "Free," she said. She spoke with still and brooding scorn. "Free? What's freedom done? Except get Mars Gale killed, made a bigger fool out in pomp than even the Lord himself could do. Free? Don't talk to me about freedom." This was the third phantom. With this phantom, the child, and he little better than a phantom too then, that same child now thinks beside the fading window, talked about the ghost. They never tired. The child with rapt, wide, half-dread and half-delight, and the old woman with musing and savage sorrow and pride. But this, to the child, was just peaceful shuddering of delight. He found no terror in the knowledge that his grandfather, on the contrary, had killed men by the hundreds, as he was told and believed, or in the fact that the Negro Pomp had been trying to kill a man when he died. No horror here, because they were just ghosts, never seen in the flesh, heroic, simple, warm. While the father, which he knew and feared, was a phantom which would never die. "So it's no wonder," he thinks, "that I skipped a generation. It's no wonder that I had no father, and that I had already died one night 20 years before I saw light. and that my only salvation must be to return to the place to die where my life had already ceased before it began.
This ends Disc 15.
While at the seminary, after he first came there, he often thought how he would tell them, the elders, the high and sanctified men who were the destiny of the church to which he'd willingly surrendered, how he would go to them and say, "Listen, God must call me to Jefferson because my life died there. Was shot from the saddle of a galloping horse in a Jefferson street one night 20 years before it was ever born." He thought that he could say that at first. He believed that they would comprehend. He went there, chose that as his vocation with that as his purpose. But he believed in more than that. He'd believed in the church, too, in all that it ramified and evoked. He believed with a calm joy that if ever there were shelter, it would be the church, that if ever truth could walk naked and without shame or fear, it would be in the seminary. When he believed that he had heard the call, it seemed to him that he could see his future, his life, intact, and on all sides complete and inviolable, like a classic and serene vase where the spirit could be born anew, sheltered from the harsh gale of living, and die so, peacefully, with only the far sound of the circumvented wind, with scarce even a handful of rotting dust to be disposed of. That was what the word seminary meant. Quiet and safe walls within which the hampered and garment-worried spirit could learn anew serenity, to contemplate without horror or alarm its own nakedness. "But there are more things in heaven and earth, too, than truth," he thinks, paraphrases, quietly, not quizzical, not humorous, not unquizzical, and not humorless, too. Sitting in the falling dusk, his head in its white bandage looming bigger and more ghostly than ever, he thinks, "More things indeed." Thinking how ingenuity was apparently given man in order that he may supply himself in crises with shapes and sounds with which to guard himself from truth. He had at least one thing to not repent, that he hadn't made the mistake of telling the elders what he'd planned to say. He hadn't needed to live in the seminary a year before he learned better than that. And more, worse, that with the learning of it, instead of losing something, he had gained, had escaped from something. And that gain had colored the very face and shape of love. She was the daughter of one of the ministers, the teachers in the college. Like himself, she was an only child. He believed at once that she was beautiful, because he'd heard of her before he ever saw her, and when he did see her, he didn't see her at all because of the face which he'd already created in his mind. He didn't believe that she could have lived there all her life and not be beautiful. He didn't see the face itself for 3 years. By that time there had already been, for 2 years, a hollow tree in which they left notes for one another. If he believed about that at all, he believed that the idea had sprung spontaneously between them, regardless of whichever one thought of it, said it first. But in reality, he'd got the idea not from her or from himself, but from a book. But he didn't see her face at all. He didn't see a small oval narrowing too sharply to chin and passionate with discontent. She was a year or two or three older than he was, and he didn't know it, was never to know it. He didn't see that for 3 years her eyes had watched him with almost desperate calculation, like those of a harassed gambler. Then, one night, he saw her, looked at her. She spoke suddenly and savagely of marriage. It was without preamble or warning. It had never been mentioned between them. He hadn't even ever thought of it, thought the word. He'd accepted it because most of the faculty were married. But to him it wasn't men and women in sanctified and living physical intimacy, but a dead state, carried over into and existing still among the living, like two shadows chained together with the shadow of a chain. He was used to that. He'd grown up with a ghost. Then one evening she talked suddenly, savagely. When he found out at last what she meant by escape from her present life, he felt no surprise. He was too innocent. "Escape," he said. "Escape from what?" "This," she said. He saw her face for the first time as a living face, as a mask before desire and hatred, wrung, blind, headlong with passion. Not stupid, just blind. Reckless, desperate. "All of it! All! All!" He wasn't surprised. He believed at once that she was right, and that he just hadn't known better. He believed at once that his own belief about the seminary had been wrong all the while. Not seriously wrong, but false, incorrect. Perhaps he'd already begun to doubt himself, without knowing it until now. Perhaps that was why he hadn't yet told them why he must go to Jefferson. He'd told her, a year ago, why he wanted to, must, go there, and that he intended to tell them the reason. She, watching him with those eyes which he hadn't yet seen. "You mean," he said, "that they wouldn't send me? Arrange for me to go? That wouldn't be reason enough?" "Certainly it wouldn't," she said. "But why? That's the truth. Foolish, maybe, but true. And what is the church for, if not to help those who are foolish, but who want truth? Why wouldn't they let me go?" "Why, I wouldn't let you go myself, if I were them and you gave me that as your reason." "Oh," he said, "I see." But he didn't see exactly, though he believed that he could have been wrong and that she was right. And so when a year later she talked to him suddenly of marriage and escape in the same words, he wasn't surprised, not hurt. He just thought quietly, "So this is love. I see. I was wrong about it, too." Thinking as he had thought before and would think again, and as every other man has thought, how false the most profound book turns out to be when applied to life. He changed completely. They planned to be married. He knew now that he had seen all the while that desperate calculation in her eyes. Perhaps they were right in putting love into books, he thought quietly. Perhaps it could not live anywhere else. The desperation was still in them, but now that there were definite plans, a day set, it was quieter, mostly calculation. They talked now of his ordination, of how he could get Jefferson as his call. "We'd better go to work right away," she said. He told her that he'd been working for that since he was 4 years old. Perhaps he was being humorous, whimsical. She brushed it aside with that passionate and leashed humorlessness, almost inattention, talking as though to herself of men, names, to see, to grovel to, or threaten, outlining to him a campaign of abasement and plotting. He listened. Even the faint smile, whimsical, quizzical, perhaps of despair, didn't leave his face. He said, "Yes, yes, I see. I understand," as she talked. It was as if he were saying, "Yes, I see. I see now. That's how they do such, gain such. That's the rule. I see now." At first, When the demagoguery, the abasement, the small lying had its reverberation in other small lies and ultimate threats in the form of requests and suggestions among the hierarchate of the church, and he received the call to Jefferson, he forgot how he had got it for the time. He didn't remember until after he was settled in Jefferson, certainly not while the train of the journey's last stage fled toward the consummation of his life across a land similar to that where he'd been born. But it looked different, though he knew that the difference lay not outside but inside the car window, against which his face was almost pressed like that of a child, while his wife beside him had also now something of eagerness in her face, beside hunger and desperation. They'd been married now not quite 6 months. They'd married directly after his graduation. Not once since then had he seen the desperation naked in her face, but neither had he seen passion again. And again he thought quietly, without much surprise, and perhaps without hurt, "I see. That's the way it is. Marriage. Yes, I see now." The train rushed on. Leaning to the window, watching the fleeing countryside, he talked in the bright, happy voice of a child. "I could have come to Jefferson before, at almost any time, but I didn't. I could have come at any time. Now, there's a difference, you know, between civilian and military casualness." Military casualness? Ah, it was the casualness of desperation. A handful of men, he wasn't an officer, I think that was the only point on which father and old Cynthia were ever in accord, that grandfather wore no sword, galloped with no sword waving in front of the rest of them, performing with the grim levity of schoolboys a prank so foolhardy that the troops who had opposed them for 4 years didn't believe that even they would have attempted it. Riding for 100 miles through a country where every grove and hamlet had its Yankee bivouac and into a garrison town. I know the very street that they rode into town upon and then out again. I've never seen it, but I know exactly how it will look. I know exactly how the house that we will some day own and live in upon the street will look. It won't be at first for a while. We'll have to live in the parsonage at first. But soon, as soon as we can, where we can look out the window and see the street, maybe even the hoof marks or their shapes in the air, because the same air will be there even if the dust, the mud, is gone. Hungry, gaunt, yelling, setting fire to the store depots of a whole carefully planned campaign and riding out again. No looting at all, no stopping for even shoes, tobacco. I tell you, they weren't men after spoils and glory. They were boys, riding the sheer tremendous tidal wave of desperate living. Boys. Because this is beautiful. Listen, try to see it. Here is that fine shape of eternal youth and virginal desire which makes heroes, that makes the doings of heroes border so close upon the unbelievable that it's no wonder that their doings must emerge now and then like gun flashes in the smoke, and that their very physical passing becomes rumor with 1,000 faces before breath is out of them. Lest paradoxical truth outrage itself. Now this is what Cynthia told me, and I believe. I know. It's too fine to doubt. It's too fine, too simple, ever to have been invented by white thinking. A Negro might have invented it, and if Cynthia did, I still believe. Because even fact can't stand with it. I don't know whether Grandfather's squadron were lost or not. I don't think so. I think that they did it deliberately, as boys who had set fire to an enemy's barn without taking so much as a shingle or a door hasp might pause in flight to steal a few apples from a neighbor, a friend. Mind you, they were hungry. They'd been hungry for 3 years. Perhaps they were used to that. Anyway, they'd just set fire to tons of food and clothing and tobacco and liquors, taking nothing, though there'd not been issued any order against looting. And they turned now, with all that for background, backdrop, the consternation, the conflagration, and the sky itself must have been on fire. You can see it, hear it, the shouts, the shots, the shouting of triumph and terror, the drumming hooves, the trees uprearing against that red glare as though fixed too in terror, the sharp gables of houses, like the jagged edge of the exploding and ultimate earth. Now, it's a close place you can feel, hear in the darkness, horses pulled short up, plunging, clashes of arms, whispers over loud, hard breathing, the voices still triumphant. Behind them, the rest of the troops galloping past toward the rallying bugles. That you must hear, feel. Then you see. You see before the crash, in the abrupt red glare, the horses with wide eyes and nostrils and tossing heads, sweat-stained, the gleam of metal, the white, gaunt faces of living scarecrows who haven't eaten all they wanted at one time since they could remember. Perhaps some of them had already dismounted. Perhaps one or two had already entered the henhouse. All this you see before the crash of the shotgun comes. Then, blackness again. It was just the one shot. And of course he would be right in the way of it, Cynthia said. Stealing chickens. A man growed with a married son going to war while his business was killing Yankees, killed in somebody else's hen house with a handful of fetters. Stealing chickens. His voice was high, childlike, exalted. Already his wife was clutching at his arm. Shh! Shh! People are looking at you. But he didn't seem to hear her at all. His thin, sick face, his eyes seemed to exude a kind of glow. That was it. They didn't know who fired the shot. They never did know. They didn't try to find out. May have been a woman. Likely enough the wife of a Confederate soldier. I like to think so. It's fine, so. Any soldier can be killed by the enemy in the heat of battle by a weapon approved by the arbiters and rulemakers of warfare, or by a woman in a bedroom, but not with a shotgun, a fowling piece in a hen house. And so is it any wonder that this world is peopled principally by the dead? Surely when God looks about at their successes, he can't be loath to share his own with us. Hush! They are looking at us. Then the train was slowing into the town. The dingy purlieus slid vanishing past the window. He still looked out, a thin, vaguely untidy man with still upon him something yet of the undimmed glow of his calling, his vocation, quietly surrounding and enclosing and guarding his urgent heart, thinking quietly how surely heaven must have something of the color and shape of whatever village or hill or cottage of which the believer says, "This is my own." The train stopped. The slow aisle, still interrupted without looking. Then the descent among faces grave, decorous, and judicial. The voices, the murmurs, the broken phrases, kindly yet still reserved of judgment. Not yet giving, and, let us say it, prejudicial. I admitted that, he thinks. I believe that I accepted it. But perhaps that's all I did do, God forgive me. The earth has almost faded from sight. It's almost night now. His bandaged, distorted head has no depth, no solidity. Immobile, it seems to hang suspended above the twin pale blobs which are his hands, lying upon the ledge of the open window. He leans forward. Already he can feel the two instants about to touch. The one which is the sum of his life, which renews itself between each dark and dusk, and the suspended instant out of which the soon will presently begin. When he was younger, when his net was still too fine for waiting, at this moment he would sometimes trick himself and believe that he heard them before he knew that it was time. Perhaps that is all I ever did, have ever done, he thinks, thinking of the faces of old men naturally dubious of his youth and jealous of the church which they were putting into his hands, almost as a father surrenders a bride, the faces of old men lined by that sheer accumulation of frustration and doubt which is so often the other side of the picture of hale and respected full years. The side, by the way, which the subject and proprietor of the picture has to look at, can't escape looking at. They did their part. They played by the rules, he thinks. I was the one who failed, who infringed. Perhaps that is the greatest social sin of all. Aye, perhaps moral sin. Thinking goes quietly, tranquilly, flowing on, falling into shapes, quiet, not assertive, not reproachful, not particularly regretful. He sees himself a shadowy figure among shadows, paradoxical, with a kind of false optimism and egoism, believing that he would find in that part of the church which most blunders, dream recovering. Among the blind passions and the lifted hands and voices of men, that which he had failed to find in the church's cloistered apotheosis upon earth. It seems to him that he's seen it all the while, that that which is destroying the church is not the outward groping of those within it, nor the inward groping of those without, but the professionals who control it and who've removed the bells from its steeples. He seems to see them endless, without order, empty, symbolical, bleak, sky-pointed not with ecstasy or passion, but in adjuration, threat, and doom. He seems to see the churches of the world like a rampart, like one of those barricades of the Middle Ages planted with dead and sharpened stakes against truth and against that peace in which to sin and be forgiven, which is the life of man. And I accepted that, he thinks. I acquiesced. Nay, I did worse. I served it. I served it by using it to forward my own desire. I came here where faces full of bafflement and hunger and eagerness waited for me, waiting to believe. I didn't see them. Where hands were raised for what they believed that I would bring them, I didn't see them. I brought with me one trust, perhaps the first trust of man, which I'd accepted of my own will before God. I considered that promise and trust of so little worth that I didn't know that I'd even accepted it. And if that was all I did for her, what could I have expected? What could I have expected save disgrace and despair and the face of God turned away in very shame? Perhaps in the moment when I revealed to her not only the depth of my hunger, but the fact that never and never would she have any part in the assuaging of it, perhaps at that moment I became her seducer and her murderer, author and instrument of her shame and death. After all, there must be some things for which God cannot be accused by man and held responsible. There must be. Thinking begins to slow now. It slows like a wheel beginning to run in sand. The axle, the vehicle, the power which propels it, not yet aware. He seems to watch himself among faces, always among and closed and surrounded by faces, as though he watched himself in his own pulpit from the rear of the church, or as though he were a fish in a bowl. And more than that, the faces seem to be mirrors in which he watches himself. He knows them all. He can read his doings in them. He seems to see reflected in them a figure antic as a showman, a little wild, a charlatan preaching worse than heresy, in utter disregard of that whose very stage he preempted, offering, instead of the crucified shape of pity and love, a swaggering and unchastened bravo, killed with a shotgun in a peaceful henhouse, in a temporary hiatus of his own avocation of killing. The wheel of thinking slows. The axle knows it now, but the vehicle itself is still unaware. He sees the faces which surround him mirror astonishment, puzzlement, then outrage, then fear, as if they looked beyond his wild antics and saw behind him and looking down upon him, in his turn unaware, the final and supreme face itself, cold, terrible, because of its omniscient detachment. He knows that they see more than that, that they see the trust of which he proved himself unworthy, being used now for his chastisement. It seems to him now that he talks to the face. Perhaps I accepted more than I could perform. But is that criminal? Shall I be punished for that? Shall I be held responsible for that which was beyond my power? And the face, it was not to accomplish that, that you accepted her. You took her as a means toward your own selfishness, as an instrument to be called to Jefferson, not for my ends, but for your own. Is that true, he thinks? Could that have been true? He sees himself again as when the shame came. He remembers that which he had sensed before it was born, hiding it from his own thinking. He sees himself offer as a sop fortitude and forbearance and dignity, making it appear that he resigned his pulpit for a martyr's reasons, when at the very instant there was within him a leaping and triumphant surge of denial behind a face which had betrayed him, believing itself safe behind the lifted hymn book, when the photographer pressed his bulb. He seems to watch himself, alert, patient, skillful, playing his cards well, making it appear that he was being driven uncomplaining into that which he didn't even then admit had been his desire since before he entered the seminary, and still casting his sops as though he were flinging rotten fruit before a drove of hogs, the meager income from his father which he continued to divide with the Memphis institution, allowing himself to be persecuted, to be dragged from his bed at night and carried into the woods and beaten with sticks, he all the while bearing in the town's sight and hearing, without shame, with that patient and voluptuous ego of the martyr, the air, the behavior, the how long, O Lord, until inside his house again and the door locked, he lifted the mask with voluptuous and triumphant glee. Ah, that's done now. That's past now. That's bought and paid for now. But I was young then, he thinks. I too had to do not what I could, but what I knew. Thinking is running too heavily now. He should know it, sense it. Still, the vehicle is unaware of what is approaching. And after all, I have paid. I have bought my ghost, even though I did pay for it with my life. And who can forbid me doing that? It's any man's privilege to destroy himself, so long as he doesn't injure anyone else, so long as he lives to and of himself. He stopped suddenly, motionless, unbreathing. There comes upon him a consternation which is about to be actual horror. He's aware of the sand now. With the realization of it, he feels within himself a gathering as though for some tremendous effort. Progress now is still progress, yet it's now indistinguishable from the recent past, like the already traversed inches of sand which cling to the turning wheel, raining back with a dry hiss that before this should have warned him. Revealed to my wife my hunger, my ego, instrument of her despair and shame. And without having thought it at all, the sentence seems to stand full sprung across his skull, behind his eyes. I don't want to think this. I must not think this. I dare not think this. As he sits in the window, leaning forward above his motionless hands, sweat begins to pour from him, springing out like blood and pouring. Out of the instant, the sand-clutched wheel of thinking turns on with the slow implacability of a medieval torture instrument. Beneath the wrenched and broken sockets of his spirit, his life. Then, if this is so, if I am the instrument of her despair and death, then I am in turn instrument of someone outside myself. And I know that for 50 years I haven't even been clay. I have been a single instant of darkness in which a horse galloped and a gun crashed. And if I am my dead grandfather on the instant of his death, then my wife, his grandson's wife, the debaucher and murderer of my grandson's wife, since I could neither let my grandson live or die. The wheel, released, seems to rush on with a long, sighing sound. He sits motionless in its aftermath, in his cooling sweat, while the sweat pours and pours. The wheel whirls on. It's going fast and smooth now because it's free now of burden, of vehicle, axle, all. In the lambent suspension of August, into which night is about to fully come, it seems to engender and surround itself with a faint glow like a halo. The halo is full of faces. The faces aren't shaped with suffering, not shaped with anything, not horror, pain, not even reproach. They're peaceful, as though they've escaped into an apotheosis. His own is among them. In fact, they all look a little alike, composite of all the faces which he's ever seen. But he can distinguish them, one from another, his wife's, townspeople, members of that congregation which denied him, which had met him at the station that day with eagerness and hunger. Byron Bunches, the woman with the child, and that of the man called Christmas. This face alone isn't clear. It's confused more than any other, as though in the now peaceful throes of a more recent, a more inextricable compositeness. Then he can see that it's two faces which seem to strive, but not of themselves striving or desiring it. He knows that. but because of the motion and desire of the wheel itself, in turn to free themselves one from the other, then fade and blend again. But he's seen now the other face, the one that isn't Christmas. Why, it's, he thinks, I have seen it recently. Why, it's that boy with that black pistol, automatic, they call him. The one who, into the kitchen where, killed, who fired the, then it seems to him that some ultimate damned flood within him breaks and rushes away. He seems to watch it, feeling himself losing contact with earth, lighter and lighter, emptying, floating. I am dying, he thinks. I should pray. I should try to pray. But he doesn't. He doesn't try. With all air, all heaven, filled with the lost and unheeded crying of all the living who ever lived, wailing still like lost children among the cold and terrible stars. I wanted so little. I asked so little. It would seem. The wheel turns on. It spins now, fading, without progress, as though turned by that final flood which had rushed out of him, leaving his body empty and lighter than a forgotten leaf, and even more trivial than flotsam lying spent and still upon the window ledge, which has no solidity beneath hands that have no weight, so that it can be now. Now. It's as though they'd merely waited until he could find something to pant with, to be reaffirmed in triumph and desire with this last left of honor and pride and life. He hears above his heart the thunder increase, myriad and drumming. Like a long sighing of wind in trees it begins. Then they sweep into sight, borne now upon a cloud of phantom dust. They rush past, forward leaning in the saddles, with brandished arms, beneath whipping ribbons from slanted and eager lances. With tumult and soundless yelling they sweep past like a tide whose crest is jagged with the wild heads of horses and the brandished arms of men like the crater of the world in explosion. They rush past, are gone. The dust swirls skyward, sucking, fades away into the night, which has fully come. Yet leaning forward in the window, his bandaged head huge and without depth above the twin blobs of his hands upon the ledge, it seems to him that he still hears them. The wild bugles, and the clashing sabers, and the dying thunder of hooves.